Rabbi Hurwitz, who by this time needs no introduction. I think this is your sixth or seventh time speaking over the weekend. So at three different locations. So it's a pleasure to have you. Rabbi Hurwitz will be speaking on a hot topic, in my mind. I don't know what he's going to say exactly, but on the separation of church and state, Moshe and Aaron. I guess one represents the church or the synagogue, and one represents the state. Rabbi Hurwitz, Vakasha.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rabbi Kalman. Again, and since this is the last time I'm speaking, this time in for Torah Moshe, I want to thank Rabbi Kalman, everyone for setting all this up. I always love speaking. My mother has always pointed it out to me. He never stopped. And Baruch Hashem. I like to give good bibliographic sources. So here's an amazing book, and won a prize by Professor Gerald Blitzstein, Yaakov Blitzstein. It's a Hebrew book, Ekronot Medinim B'Mishnat HaRambam. And I guess it will be translated as Political Concepts in Maimonidean Halacha. This book was published in 1983, was republished 2001. It's an amazing book, and certain sources I have really come from this book, and more importantly, certain ideas were helped shape by Professor Blitzstein's work. Now, the topic of church and state and separation of powers is so broad, there's no way I could hope to treat it in its entirety. What I'm going to do simply is discuss three texts. One is all from the medieval period. One is a celebrated Ramban in Parshas Vayechi concerning the blessing of Yaakov to Yehuda. It's a famous Ramban that you might know in the context of Hanukkah, in which Ramban tries to explain why Chazal have a negative attitude towards the Chashmonaim. The second is Lahavdil, a non-Jewish text from around the year 1300, looking at Moshe and Aaron, and I'm going to remarkably find a certain parallel in current contemporary halachic sources. An idea from, you might have heard of, Reb Chaim Zimmerman, who from a totally different vantage point comes to the same idea. My grandfather, Lev Shalom, used to say that if different people come to the same conclusion, when you're learning a sugya, and the Pnei Yeshua says something, and Kiv Eges says something, and the Sfas Emes says something, all saying essentially the same word, that might be indicative of a greater probability that it's correct. So I always love when two people come from totally different perspectives and say a similar thing, that I think should give us pause and say, hey, you know what, this really might be what's going on. Finally, I hope time will permit, I'm going to try to discuss a celebrated idea from the Ran, like the Ramban, living in Spain, Drashos HaRan, pertaining to Parsha Shoftim. Now, I gave a different form of this lecture in the United States, then I realized, in Canada, there is no establishment clause in Canada. I spoke briefly this morning to a friend of mine, Yitz Kurtz, so every time I'm here, I reconnect with him. The United States, of course, has, in the Bill of Rights, the First 10 Amendments of the Constitution, the First Amendment said includes what's called the Establishment Clause. There shall be no establishment of a church in the United States. Now, obviously that doesn't fit here 100%, but I think we'll get the ideas as they pertain. So the first text, Ramban, I believe, will lead to the notion of separation of church and state, at least according to one interpretation of that doctrine as formulated in the United States Constitution. The second text will point to a distinction between judicial powers and executive powers, and sometimes the executive may override the judicial powers, and this is because of the principle of maintenance and upkeep of a society. And finally, the third text, the Ran, will give a fascinating analysis of the conceptual substructure of the difference between judicial powers and executive powers, as we shall see. Let's begin with the Ramban. The Ramban in Parshas Vayechi comments at length on the pasuk Lo Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda, the scepter, the Shevet, which Chazal have interpreted traditionally as referring to kingship over the rest of the Jewish people, shall not depart from Judah. Now Ramban deals with a whole host of issues in his comments to that verse, not least of these, including an oblique or not so oblique defense of Judaism against Christological interpretations of that verse. The Christians used to quote this pasuk to say it's approved to them. Lo yosur shevet mi Yehuda, choki mi ben raglav, ad ki yavo Shiloh. Right? There will be a Jewish kingship until Shiloh, which they interpreted as Mashiach will come, and then the Jewish kingdom will cease. And they'll say that's roughly what happened. Yeah, through the second base of Mikdash, you had kings of the Jewish people, and then, of course, it ended, and then Jesus came, and there's no more Jewish kings. So Rabban, of course, rejects that. We'll discuss that in a second. But Ramban says, Lo Yasu Shevet Mi Yehuda means when there is a Jewish king, the proper king must come from Shevet Yehuda. So Ramban says, certainly the pasuk is not maintaining the idea that there will always be throughout Jewish history a Jewish king. That simply is not true. If only because in the 70 years between Bais Rishon and Bais Sheni, there was no Jewish king. So the pasuk is not saying that. The pasuk is not making a historical claim that there always will be a Jewish king. The pasuk is what the Ramban calls Tzavoas Zokain. It's the command of the elder, meaning Jacob, Yaakov, that when there is a king, the king should come from Shevet Yehuda. Okay, I'm not going to read right now inside. I first want to get more of the material orally. Then the Ramban raises the question, why did Chazal have a negative attitude towards the Chashmonaim? Well, this is, in his view, a direct consequence of this rule. Ramban writes as follows. I have the English translation also. In my opinion, the kings from other tribes who ruled over Israel after David, who of course was from the tribe of Judah, went against the words of their father Jacob by diverting the inheritance of Judah to another tribe. That was a bad thing. Now, of course, if you look at the Sefer Melachim, you will see that Yeravam was initially appointed by Achia Shiloni, but it was wrong for him to take it too far. Now, they relied on the word Achia HaShiloni, the prophet who anointed Yeravam, who said, and I will for this afflict the seed of David, but not forever. But when the 10 tribes of Israel continued to crown kings, one after another of the rest of the tribes, and they did not revert to the kingdom of Judah. In other words, Ramban said, what should have happened is the northern kingdom, after a while, should have said, okay, let's reunite with a king under the southern kingdom of Judah. They transgressed the testament of the ancestor, that's Tzavoas Zokain, and they were accordingly punished. Just as the prophet Hosea said, they have set up kings, but not for me. Then the Ramban continues. This was also the reason for the punishment of the Chashmonaim, who reigned during the Second Temple. In other words, they were not just Kohanim Gedolim, they were kings. They were saints of the Most High. In other words, let's not minimize what the Maccabees did, without whom the learning of the Torah and the observance of the commandments would have been forgotten in Israel. And despite this, they suffered such great punishment. Now the Ramban, in his ideas, saying the tragic end of all the five brothers was because of this sin. Okay, we're not discussing whether or not we agree ideologically with the Ramban. We're simply quoting what the Ramban says. The four sons of the old Chashmonai Matisyahu, saintly men who ruled one after another, in spite of all their prowess and success, fell by the sword of their enemies. And ultimately, the punishment reached the stage where rabbis of blessed memory said, he who says, I come from the house of the Chashmonaim is a slave, as they were all destroyed on account of this sin. This Ramban is remarkable. The Talmud says that some, and this is corroborated by other sources, some of the descendants of the Chashmonaim became Sadducees, Sadukim. So you would have thought, if somebody wants to understand why were they punished, this was the sin. Ramban doesn't go there. He continues. Now, although among the children of Simon, one of the Chashmonaim, there was cause for punishment on account of the Sadducees, and the reference here is that Yochanan Hyrcanus, the son of Simon Maccabee, became a member of the Sadducees, all the children, all of them, of the righteous Matisyahu the Chashmonai were deposed for this only. They ruled even though they were not of the seed of Judah and of the house of David, and thus they completely removed the scepter and the lawgiver from Judah. Lo Yasser Shevet Miyehuda is directed to the rest of the Jewish people. They must not take the kingship away from the descendants of Judah. And their punishment was measure for measure, as the Holy One, blessed be He, caused their slaves to rule over them, Edom, and it is they who destroyed them. Okay, if we would stop here, so we simply have an adamant application of the rule that a legitimate king in Judaism, be the reason what it may, must be from the tribe of Judah. But according to this, the fact that the Chashmonaim were priests is irrelevant. There would be no difference between a priest violating the prerogative of Yehuda and someone from Shevet Binyamin or Zebulun doing so. But the Ramban goes on. It is also possible that, in addition to the Chashmonaim having sinned for assuming royalty when they were not of the tribe of Judah, here's coming, they sinned in ruling on account of their being priests. That was an extra added sin. Who have been commanded, guard your priesthood in everything that pertains to the altar and to within the veil, and you shall serve. I give you the priesthood as the service of gifts. That's a translation on the Pasuk in Parshas Korach. Thus it was not for them to rule, but only to perform the service of God. So here I think we begin to see an idea of, you know, with all differences notwithstanding, separation of the priests and the political leaders. So I think these last words of Ramban seem to prefigure some notion of separation of church and state. But it's not that simple. Which notion of church and state are we referring to? Now, when I was here Labor Day weekend, they quoted a cousin of mine, Yehuda Mirsky, in his dissertation on Rav Kook. So now I'm going to quote something else that Yehuda Mirsky wrote. This is an article he wrote in Yale Law Review in the mid-80s. And his article is called Civil Religion and the Establishment Clause, published in the Yale Law Journal in 1986. So again, I'm discussing from the point of view of constitutional law in the United States, not Canada, but I trust the conceptual point will be clear. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, the first of the 10 Bill of Rights, reads in part, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That is why today there are so many rules in the United States regarding practices, tests, and symbols that are readily classifiable in both political and religious terms. So is putting up a Hanukkah menorah a violation of the Establishment Clause, or is it not a violation of the Establishment Clause, right? Is putting up a creche and all Christian symbols a violation or not? And that's what Ad Yom Hazeh, the Supreme Court, is trying to, you know, thread the needle exactly the way they think it should be. We do know that the Constitution forbids such legitimization if it leads to establishment of a religion. Where do you draw the line? So Mirsky writes, there are three frames of reference for understanding separation of church and state. Those are three svaras. He's going that conceptually here. And there are three ways to understand the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution, each named for its earliest exponent. Number one, the Jeffersonian School. This is marked by a disdain for organized religion, a profound fear of theocracy, and an outright contempt for all clerics and their beliefs. The historian Peter Gay, in his book The Enlightenment and Interpretation, The Rise of Modern Paganism, you can tell from the title, discusses the European intellectual climate that formed the Jeffersonian position. So certainly you can't push the Ramban into Jefferson, no matter how hard you try. So that's out. Certainly, we don't have any disdain for organized religion. Then number two is the Madisonian position. The Madisonian position sees the Establishment Clause as a means of discouraging government by any one particular religious group. It wants a multiplicity of mutually balancing sects. Right? That's why just like you have the judicial, executive, the legislature, then you have all these different groups. You have the House of Representatives, the Senate. You know, everyone is balancing everybody else. So there's no hostility to religion per se, just a desire to ensure that no one group would get the upper hand. Therefore, Madison's goal was that all different groups should compete for adherence and define themselves in relation to each other. And the result is a creative equilibrium. So that really can't fit into the Ramban as well. Because again, yes, we do have, you know, Machlokes Beshamayim Beisila, but at the end of the day, there is a line which is, you know, the rabbinic tradition, the halacha, and that's it. So the Ramban would certainly say, we as Jews have infused and should infuse our religion into our public square. And in the Jewish Commonwealth in Israel, we knew there was the one true religion. Although a Ger Toshav, a non-Jew who follows the seven mitzvot of Bnei Noach, is allowed to live in Israel, but the religion of Israel was Judaism. So the Madisonian view doesn't really fit either. But remarkably, there is a third perspective to the Establishment Clause that Mirsky quotes, and I believe this fits beautifully with the Ramban. This third perspective was that of Roger Williams, the founder of Rhode Island. I once gave a different version of this shiur in Providence, Rhode Island, so I was able to quote their hometown hero. That does not work, I guess, in Toronto or anywhere else in Ontario or anywhere else in Canada. In any event, Roger Williams had a different view of disestablishment of religion. He said it's to preserve the purity of the church itself, to keep it free of political partisanship. Mirsky cites the book written 50 years ago, which perfectly captures the point of Roger Williams' notion of the separation of church and state. The title was The Garden and the Wilderness. The ministers of the church are commanded to be in the pure garden. The political sphere is the wilderness, and the church leaders should not be corrupted by leaving their bastion of ecclesiastical purity. In my opinion, the Ramban, regarding the Chashmonaim, that last point where he says it's a separate Isser for them as Kohanim to become king, fits perfectly with Roger Williams' view of separation of church and state. Or to be more precise, a separation of the persons who would represent and express the power of the church, in our case a synagogue, and the persons who would represent and have the power of the state from the perspective of Roger Williams. A Lamdin, if he was learning Gemara and he would see what Roger Williams said, he would express his position as follows. Separation of church and state is not a din in the state, it's a din in the church. They have to be in the Beis HaMikdash. They have to be focused upon God. So therefore, when the Chashmonaim decide to become kings, and then you look in the Book of Maccabees and the treaties with Rome, and they're involved in military campaigns, that was not their job as Kohanim. The priest should be in the holy precincts of the temple, not in the secular world of the garden. And this is the same point that Ramban is stressing here. What emerges is the realization that the fact that the Maccabees stemmed from Kohanim made their violation of Lo Yasu Sheyudim Yehuda even worse than it had it been if they were from the tribe of, for example, Binyamin. Okay, now that we've discussed the Ramban, I'd like to comment briefly on the two separate roles represented by the two figures of Moshe and Aaron that I alluded to in the title of my lecture. Chazal say, Moshe Rabbeinu Melech Haya. He was a king. Now, obviously, certain things are not going to fit 100% because obviously Moshe was not from Shevet Yehuda, and that's another topic. Obviously, you had King Shaul. Let's put it this way. We can simply assume, the Ramban already assumes that Shaul was not a 100% a king. We won't discuss this now. Certainly the implementation of Lo Yasu Shevim Yehuda started officially with David HaMelech. Let's grant that. But with all the differences entailed, I think we see with Moshe and Aaron the same idea. You had two separate figures. Aaron was the Kohen Gadol, who will go into, then it was the Mishkan, later on it will be for his descendants the Beit HaMikdash. He could go Lefnai V'Lefnim to the Kodesh Kodoshim once a year on Yom Kippur. He was in the ecclesiastical garden. And the political leader, who was Moshe, was in the wilderness. So it's appealing to suggest that this separation of powers, if only in the sense of Roger Williams, are already adumbrated by the respective powers of Moshe and Aaron. Now, actually, this point was made quite clearly in the Middle Ages, Lahavdil, by a non-Jewish scholar who looked at the Bible. First, let me give some background. Some of you might have heard of Marsilius of Padua. He wrote a book called Defensor Pacis, the Defender of the Peace. He was an Italian scholar. His dates are not so clear, from circa 1275 to circa 1342. The scholars say he wrote Defensor Pacis 1324, which is a little bit after the Ramban. And this treatise was created in the context of a power struggle between the Pope, Pope John XXII, and Louis of Bavaria. Germans called him Ludwig of Bavaria, who was the candidate for the Holy Roman Empire. And there were these big fights. Who's going to have the power, the king or the Pope? And Marsilius, in Defensor Pacis, sought to demonstrate by arguments from reason and by arguments from authority the independence of the Holy Roman Empire from the papacy and the emptiness of the prerogatives alleged to have been usurped by the sovereign pontiffs. And Dafka, the king, has the right to issue laws for his kingdom. Now, see, the Pope, it really started from Boniface, the previous Pope. They were extremely aggressive in their assertion of papal power, and some popes claim that the king is really just their agent, that the pope has both ecclesiastical and secular power. Pope Boniface basically says that no person will get chelek yolam haba, talking to the other Catholics, if you don't believe that I, Boniface, have total authority in every single jurisdiction of life. And therefore, he passed, and everyone else that doesn't accept that will burn in hell. Now, question is, where did Marsilius, who had a very strong demarcation of church and state, get his ideas? And he does refer somewhat to Moshe and Aaron. So Walter Ullmann, that's the figure I alluded to before, he is a scholar, wrote these extremely dense books on papal power and kingly power in the Middle Ages. I had to read one of his books for my comprehensive, my PhD. They're amazingly long, dense. Your eyes glaze over after a lot of pages. But Hashem has his ways, and I remember the name of Walter Ullmann, and this will, at least another one of his articles, will help us for this lecture. So Walter Ullmann shows that Marsilius had some precursors. There was another book written around the year 1301, 1302, called Rex Pacificus, Peaceful King, that this apparently prepared the ground for Marsilio. So, he basically says, look, there's papal power and there is kingly power, and the Pope may not encroach on the king's territory. And then he has a whole discussion. I can't get into it now, but at one point he starts talking about Moshe and Aaron. So I'll read some of the passages. He says as follows. We don't know who wrote this Rex Pacificus, but he says as follows. God decreed that the Jewish people should be guarded by political as well as spiritual leaders. Who was the first political leader? Moses. To him alone and to no one else, God said, now go and lead the people into the place. On the other hand, the first, obviously we don't accept the idea of a pope, but the first to be entrusted with spiritual leadership was Aaron. He became the first priest and Pontifex Maximus because God ordered Moses to take Aaron with him that he may minister in the priest's office. So you have Moses as the king, as the political leader, and you have Aaron as the high priest. By divine will, the two authorities were clearly kept apart. Now, there's a kasha from yesterday's parsha and parsha's Tetzaveh, in which, you know, there are some passages in which Moshe Rabbeinu is doing some of the avod that seems that he's really acting as the priest also. So he writes as follows. The author is bound to admit that it is true that a few passages may be found in which Moses is also spoken of as a priest, but this designation merely means the combined and temporal the spiritual power. This designation must not lead to the assumption that Moses was ever a priest. Priesthood, in the strict meaning of the term, was the sole prerogative of Aaron, just as political leadership was the sole prerogative of Moses. For it was Aaron who constantly offered a sacrifice to God, not Moses. And of course, Moses transferred his office to Yeshua, then to the judges, and then to the kings. Right? So that shows we're talking about political transfer of leadership. The Kohuna Gadola went from Aaron to his children. Okay. Then it's a fascinating text. The original article was written in the English Historical Review, volume 61, number 240, May 1946. So it's an old article. Now, we don't really care what Walter Ullmann says in terms of our understanding of the Torah. We're just using this as a method of, you know, of simply getting the vocabulary. So I want to know, are there statements in Chazal that support this, that reject this? Well, we have one problem, right? There's a famous Gemara in Zvachim. It's also Medrash Rav in Shmos, Parsha Tetzaveh, that said that after Matan Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu did act for a while as a Kohen Gadol. Right? Some of you may be aware of the Gemara in Zvachim like that. And it was only afterwards, after Akamas HaMishkan, Aaron, you know, became the official Kohen Gadol. So does this vitiate the entire model of the Ramban? And we can work backwards to Moshe and Aaron that, you know, Aaron is the spiritual, at least the ecclesiastical authority and Moshe's political authority. So I personally would like to find some mahalach that keeps the distinction between Moshe and Aaron, but is still faithful to this Gemara and Chazal that Moshe Rabbeinu acted as a Kohen Gadol. Of course, you could say that the situation existed until Parsha Shmini, and that's when the bifurcation began. That's one approach. That's actually an easy way to go. But I can't resist introducing here another halachic point. This was advanced by the late Reb Chaim Zimmerman and cited by Bezalel Naor. Reb Chaim Zimmerman pointed out that if you want to understand a statement, you have to really see the entire set of discussions and shots on the topic. He makes the following claim. You can't take the Gemara that says Moshe Rabbeinu was a Kohen Gadol in its broadest sense. It simply will not work. Why not? So Reb Chaim Zimmerman used the time-honored technique of following a halachic point to its conclusion, then arguing by the process of reductio ad absurdum that if you would follow to its conclusion, certain conclusions must happen, and these conclusions can't happen, they're absurd. Therefore, we can't assume the premise of the argument in the first place. So let's discuss this. If Moshe Rabbeinu had halachos of Kohen Gadol, then he would be limited in his marriage choices. Who did he marry? Who's the mother of his children? Tzipporah. There are three major problems here. Number one, Tzipporah was a convert, a gioret. Okay? This was pointed out, among others, by the Chida, the famous 18th century figure of Chaim Yosef David Avzulai, and even by the late Baba Terebi, he has in one of his sikhos, he discussed this problem. That's problem number one. Okay, we're going to get to before Matan Torah. Reb Chaim Zimmer is going to do this. That's what I'm going to do now for the next 5 to 7 minutes. He's saying whichever angle you use, you're going to get stuck. We'll see. Problem number two. Another problem exists according to the view of Rav Yoshua. According to the Mechilta, the Rashbi, they claim at one point that Moshe Rabbeinu divorced Tzipora and subsequently took her back. Therefore, he was a machzik grushaso. Okay. But a kohen, think about a kohen gadol is not allowed to take his wife that he divorced back. That's machzik grushaso. So, number one, Tzipora was a giyaret. Number two, Tzipora was a grusha. Chida asked this question as well. Then Rav Chaim Zimmerman, quoting the Shem Yishmuel, proceeded to ask a third question. And this gets into the issue of before Matan Torah, after Matan Torah. So look, we certainly know that Moshe married Tzipora in the first place before Matan Torah, right? Parsha Shmos, Yisrael had his daughters, and he married Tzipora. Now, many Rishonim, let's just accept the following point, understand that the formal institution of marriage from a halachic point of view only applies to Jews. I'm not going to discuss the theological problems with that. Let's just grant that. Now, then there's another famous question. When did the halachic status of Jews as Jews begin? There are three possibilities. Either began with Abraham, either began with Matan Torah, or there's some in-between position. We all know that the Ramban, for example, says that's why Ramban is one of the in-between positions. Ramban says that even the Avos did accept the rules of the Torah only in Eretz Yisrael, and that's why when Yaakov went back to Israel, Rachel died, because otherwise he'd be violating the Isser of marrying two sisters. But there are other views. For example, the Rambam seems to hold that the status of Jews as Jews with all the Tariq mitzvot only begin at Har Sinai, and he doesn't go with the idea that Avram, observed all 613 mitzvot. Bracket that. All these issues are debated. I would say not a single one of these issues that's brought up has any unanimity. Now, so let's assume, which Chaim Zimmer says, these two positions. Position number one, that marriage as a formal entity is a Jewish institution, and the Jews became Jews at Har Sinai. Now, so what happened? Moshe was married to Tzipora. Quote, marriage only de facto, not de jure. De jure only started at Matan Torah. What? When the Jews received, in other words, when God gave the revelation of the Torah to Sinai, that's when the Zera Avram, the children of Avram Avinu, formally became obligated in all the laws. Not before that. Before that, they were like just other children of Noah. So when did that start? So Moshe Rabbeinu married Tzipora when? Before? He was still a Ben Noach. So it wasn't really marriage. It was like, how to say about Moshe Rabbeinu, they were just living together. It was cohabitation. So the Gemara has a phrase for cohabitation. That's called mefutas atzmo. If someone seduces a girl and she agrees and they live together, that's called mefutas atzmo. Now, there's no problem for a non-Kohen to marry mefutas atzmo. There might not even be a problem for a regular Kohen, but there certainly is a problem for a Kohen Gadol to marry mefutas atzmo because she's not a virgin. So he's saying as follows. So you can't put it together. You can't use any other before Matan Torah answers to save the marriage halachically of Moshe. It's brilliant. Of Moshe and Tzipora, assuming that he was a Kohen Gadol. One more possibility, which he will or reject. In other words, just to recapitulate, when Moshe was living with Tzipora, he was halachically mefutas atzmo, he was just living with her until Matan Torah. But if you're going to say at Matan Torah he became the Kohen Gadol, he can't live with her anymore, and he obviously did. Now, there's one other problem. Okay, good, but it doesn't matter when he came back. If she came back before Mat, it doesn't matter, because if she came back before Matan Torah, okay, good. So at Matan Torah, he... No. Okay, so that's a very interesting question. The Ravon says you don't say you become born again to make a non-virgin a virgin. Okay. That's an important point. Another shear. Another smooth. Oh, hold the shtar yishtar. You're going to get to that. You're going to get to the hold the shtar yishtar. He knocks that out also. Good. That's the last problem. The Gemara says as follows. So there's one problem with this, which he proceeds to demolish. So wait a second. Chaim Zimmerman says, maybe there is one halachic, legitimate way to understand Moshe Rabbeinu. Because the halacha has the equivalent of a grandfather clause. What does that mean? Let's say you are a Kohen. A Kohen is just not allowed to marry a Grusha. He can't marry a divorcee. He can marry a widow, for example. What if a Kohen Hedyot marries a widow and then becomes elevated to the high priesthood? Does he have to get rid of her? So the Gemara in Yevamos says no. This is the rule of Hoil V'Hishtaria, because the Gemara says, Nishtaria. Since he married her when he was permitted to do so, he may stay married to her. Right? So since when the marriage was originally consummated, the man was allowed to live with such a woman, his elevation to the office of Kohen Gadol should not cause the breakup of the marriage. So now, why don't you say Hol V'Shtaria here? So Chaim Zimmerman says you can't, because the Rambam says you can't. The Rambam says explicitly that Hoel Vishtari Shtari does not refer to the case of Mefutas Atzmo. So if a guy was a Kohen Hedyo, the Kohen Stam, and he was just living with a woman, and that person gets elevated to the Kohen Gadol, he has to divorce her. He can't stay married to her. So that last, what you realize, that last problem, he says, will not save it. Why? It's very simple. At the end of the day, this man, who's now Kohen Gadol, is marrying a woman who is not a virgin and with whom he entered into a relationship outside the realm of marriage. Now, assuming... it's nothing, right? No. Well, okay. So, I'm not a derogatory. I'm calling Chaim Zimmerman. Okay. But technically, that okay. I don't mean any disrespect. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm working on Reb Chaim Zimmerman's Mahalich. It's also in the. He actually, by the way, he quotes the Shemi Shmuel. So, you know, kind of with, okay. I'm sorry you feel that way. I'm going to move in a few minutes the twist where you don't have to do that. So if you wait in a few minutes, I'm going to twist, so hopefully you won't be upset. So, it goes as follows. See, if you hold that before Matan Torah, there is no such... Well, it goes as follows. Let's work backwards. Let us assume that the status of Moshe's Kohen Gadol would have started immediately after Matan Torah. And follow the opinion when Yisro arrived on the scene with Zipporah, who Moshe proceeded to remarry after Matan Torah, right, and subsequently married Zipporah after Matan Torah, it wouldn't work, as we discussed. Now, I certainly know that there are many assumptions that could easily be rejected. But the question is like this. after these problems, Reb Chaim Zimmerman says the following. What do you see from here? There's a teretz. Once you have the teretz, you wouldn't have to say all of this. So I'd like to just present the teretz. He says, because of these problems, okay, good. Because of these problems, you cannot say that when the Gemara says Moshe Rabbeinu was Kohen Gadol, it cannot be taken literally to its fullest extent. Rather, it means Moshe had certain abilities and obligations of avoda. It was a din in service in the Mishkan. He certainly didn't have the formal designation of Yichus Kahuna. Yes, I know that. I know that. He said that's a din in avoda. That's a din in avoda. Every single Gemara. It says that's a din in the avoda. So my point is exactly what we saw before. That's been my point. It's a din. His mahalach is that when it says Moshe Rabbeinu was a Kohen, I know that Gemara, what begotim did he wear? And it's the Tosa Goran Avoda Zara, and the Tosas on that, the whole discussion. It's a din in avoda. What does that mean? That means it's exactly what we saw before. He had obligations of service in the Mishkan, but he didn't have the status of a Kohen, so he didn't have the family restrictions. So therefore, it doesn't matter anymore. You can say that there was formal Lishus, you could say there was not formal Lishus. You could say that she was a Grusha, you could say she was not a Grusha. You could say that she was the Gioris before, she was a Gioris afterwards. It doesn't matter, because since Al Pi Din, the Din that Moshe Rabbeinu, that the statements in the Gemara, that Moshe Rabbeinu was a Kohen Gadol does not refer to his person, does not refer to a lineage, rather it's a din in Avoda, therefore there's no problems, according to any view, any of the six possibilities, to marry Tzipora. So one second. What? No, so get it. That's not... What? I understand. So that's so he discussed this again. We can re-do that question. What does that mean? According to anyone that says before Man Torah, Ishto means in the de facto sense, not in the jure sense. Every single point you can raise, he deals with. So again, so the question is, okay. So I according to that opinion, I meant no disrespect. The point is to get to the conclusion, and that's the point. It's exactly what I'm trying to say, that the idea that Aaron was the Kohen, Aaron had the issues of, with his restrictions of marriage, and not Moshe, is held 100%. Yes? Okay, so right, so that was the divine decree of God that Aaron would be the. Let me make one point. So from my perspective, the upshot of all this pilfer is that one can keep the distinction between Moshe and Aaron, right? Looking at the Torah and keep halakhically 100% from this technical perspective as well. And this has, I think, the further advantage of projecting the distinction of the Ramban back into the beginnings of the Jewish nation, right? The two rules of Kahuna and Malchus, these two aspects are never joined but remain separate in the persons of Moshe and Aaron. So, Lamaskana, this is the time-honored technique of raising a question, going through Reductio ad absurdum, then coming up with a new paradigm. And with a new paradigm, you don't even have to make the assumptions of the question. Yes?
I want to ask a question about the ideals, the philosophical ideals, and the reality. In that, the ideal was that all of these were supposed to be Kohani, but they got washed out. Secondly,
yeah.
The ideal was Moshe was supposed to be going into the whole third of the last class.
Right. Okay. Right.
If the ideal is such that Moses was supposed to be the legislative leader and the religious leader at the same time, that was ideal, but it didn't work out that way because of a personal family. That's fine, that's the reality. But does our tradition say that the ideal
Well, that's a good question. I will tell you again, both sources you quoted are actually disputed. In other words, there is the Gemara that I assume you were in Francis Nataf's class before. There is the idea that, you know, Vayichar Af, that God got angry and said that Aaron would have been you would have been the Kohen Gadol also. Okay, not all sources agree with that. So the presentation that I'm presenting here is following those sources that aren't going that way. So in other words, the text never says that you would have been a Kohen. And also, certainly the tradition during the medieval period, whatever, in Rishonim, Mamleches Kohenim v'Goy Kadosh is not to be taken in a halachic sense. It's more of a evaluation, saying that you are a holy, holy people. So I would dispute, at least there are sources that dispute that point as well. So in other words, those are two, each of the two sources you mentioned are certainly disputed by other sources. In fact, the whole discussion, I won't get into now, but just food for subsequent thought. You know, it's not even 100, there's a whole discussion as to how the substitution of the Levim for the Bechorim also is not so, not so set in stone, and different opinions have different understandings of that also. So I'm going with the idea really based upon the text and the Yesod that, when it says Moshe Rabbeinu was a Kohen Gadol, it might not have been in the full sense of the word. So when I saw that, it clicked, and I saw, hey, in other words, we can really have the idea. From the get-go, there was this demarcation and separation of powers. Okay. I'll go for, what time is it now? Okay, so I'll try to push the rest in five minutes. You know, the Rambam has this idea that if a murderer kills someone with only one witness, so according to the Sanhedrin, it's finished. You don't kill him; he gets away. I mean, many of us remember the O.J. Simpson trial of 16 years ago. You know, you wonder, how could you let a murderer go free? It's so terrible. So the Rambam has a answer. Rambam says the king has special executive powers to kill an obvious murderer who there's only one witness against. That's a fascinating Rambam. I see time won't allow me to get into this, but this reminds me of other cases where the executive is able, for example, Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War in the United States suspended habeas corpus. You know, he was, and that was the executive power. So Lahavdil, that's what the Rambam does in terms of the king. It's a remarkable idea. So, look, we all know there is the Gemara in Maseches Makos where one of the Talmidim said, had I been on Sanhedrin, there would only be I put someone to death once in 7 years, once in 7 years, and they came back and said, listen, you're going to increase murderers, right? Because, you need social justice, social control. So there's a big dispute what the basis of this Rambam is. One position is Ramei Simcha Zvinsk, in the Or Sameach. So he basically said that the Rambam is basing himself on Bnei Noach. They're the Noahide laws. And we are more strict in our judicial applications. But Bnei Noach says you have one witness, you can put someone to death. So the Rambam's idea of a king becomes beyond what the Sanhedrin does and can go back to Bnei Noach. Other people, Professor Blitzin has discussion in his book, he says it might very well be due to simply the Rambam's power of the king. But the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim Girona, goes a step further, and I'll conclude with this. The Ran says there are two kohos in law and Judaism. So we discussed separation of church and state. Now this is like separation of powers within the state. There's the koach hadayonim and the koach hamelech. Hamelech can be machlus, really any executive power. Koach hadayonim means the Sanhedrin interpret the law, chukei haTorah. But they can't change the law. They can never say, well, al pidin, you murdered someone with one, only according to the testimony of one witness, you know, we can put you to death. Because they have to interpret haTorah she yarucho, what the law states. It is only the king who has that extrajudicial power to, for social control, fix matters. And Professor Blitzstein discusses that Ran, he says, it's a very beautiful idea. The Ran seems to be going in the following direction, that the king deals with society. Halacha, in its judicial system, cares about every individual. We care about individual rights. We don't want to put an individual to death unless we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he is guilty. Right? No circumstantial evidence in halacha. There must be witnesses. There must be two witnesses. All the rules and regulations. That's the Sanhedrin. The king has to deal with the society as a whole. If you're going to have this murderer keeps, you know he's the murderer. You know that he's killing people. But he's doing it stealthily with, no edus berurah. You can't allow the situation to continue. So therefore, the king has his executive powers to suspend the usual rules and regulations. And in fact, the Ran says, any case in which the Gemara says that Sanhedrin, you know, they bent the rule, let's say when Shimon ben Shatach had to kill people, they weren't using the prerogative of Sanhedrin, they were using the prerogative of Malchus. Okay, so that's a very interesting idea of separation of powers. And finally, the Ran says, precisely because the king has so much power, we understand in Judaism the importance of the humility that a king must have. Because as we know, power corrupts, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. So the Torah has to ensure that the extra measure of humility will infuse all the king's actions. That's why the Torah demands that the king carry a sefer Torah with him wherever he goes. It's not just to thwart a theoretically conceited gaiva. It's to prevent the abuse of authority. I'm the king. I could kill someone who lit eid echad. I could override the Sanhedrin. I could be all powerful. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's to prevent the abuse of authority that the king has. Because the king must do whatever he does, and that's what every political leader must do. They must only act in the interest of the Medina as a whole. And therefore the constant propinquity of the Torah to his person is an attempt to ensure that a king will never abuse his power and will always act as a servant of God. Okay, thank you.